Beneath His Skin by Cathedral Carver, read by Crazy Fangirl. Prologue. And what do you crave? He likes the way they make him feel. It's as simple as that. And it's much easier and much less embarrassing to yell at Mycroft and for Mycroft then to relate to Mummy than neurobiological disease or blood-brain barrier or, God forbid, habitual user. They slow him down or speed him up or mellow him out or sharpen his claws depending on his mood and drug choice. And anyway, it just feels so fucking good to concentrate on something other than the bloody, horrible, boring mess of the tangible world that threatens to break in and break him down day after day after day after day. And in moments of extreme weakness and sentimentality, he refers to them as his only friends. So, day after day, he lies in dark, sour-smelling places. He seeks out with his only friends, head bursting with a million brilliant, jagged colors, or sometimes no colors at all, only a heavy, soft gray, like fog, or a worn jumper, which is often preferable, and thinks, this. Just this. This nothing. This everything. This blackness. This all colors. This thing that is no longer my mind, but has filled up my mind and made it all better. At least for now, this is what I crave. One. But then it all comes to a crashing, quivering, mortifying, gloriously revolting end in the back of an alley with too much noise and too many body fluids, most of which are his own, and too many people and colors that are all too real and bright, and a hospital and a bloody rehab center, for God's sakes. And he's so furious at his brother for not only finding him, but saving him and taking away his only friends, that, out of pure spite, decides never to touch drugs again. Ever. Ever. And he doesn't. But Sherlockian resolve alone does not eradicate the longings. And oh, fuck. The longings. The cravings for those colors and no color days. The nothingness and everything. And oh. Oh. What he wouldn't do to dive back into that gray, soft abyss. And he could, too, if he wanted to. He still knows where to get them. Could purchase them, get them into his system within a half hour if he truly desired, and he does desire. In one moment of near relapse, he screams at his brother, "You took away my only friends!" To which Mycroft replies sharply, "You need new friends." So every time he sees Mycroft's smug, self-righteous, self-serving, savior-like expression, he wants to punch it hard. And then he wants to get gloriously, explosively high. Every single time. Of course, he does neither of these things. What he does get is a new occupation. What he doesn't do is look for new friends, because who the hell needs those? Two. And when he meets John Watson for the first time, It's like a punch to the gut, or a gun to the head, or a needle to the arm. All skin prickling and synapses exploding and blood rushing and limp, loose limbs and, oh God, what have I gotten myself into now? And when John Watson actually shows up at the flat, having not been completely put off by Sherlock's blatant invasive behavior and abrupt departure, Sherlock can hardly breathe with the wonder. And when he asks, "Do you want to see some more?" and John Watson says, "God, yes," what Sherlock really wants to do, he realizes, is kiss John Watson, and then get stupidly, stupendously high, and forget the notion of kissing John Watson entirely, because really, what's the point in indulging in fantasies of kissing other men, especially potential flatmate men, who are potentially and probably not interested in you in the least? But he does neither of these things, of course. Neither the kissing nor the drugs. What he does, instead, is take John Watson out for dinner, then drag him through the city streets, hoping against hope that John Watson might end up feeling something akin to the electric, rippling, all-consuming craving he suddenly has developed for him. 3. And every single fucking time, Sally calls him freak. Something curdles in his chest. But he's become so used to this particular sensation, he almost doesn't notice it anymore. Almost. But now, when she does it in front of John, the curdling becomes a roiling, splitting, throbbing nausea that reminds him of a morning after a particularly good/bad night with his only friends. When Sally calls him freak in front of John, he wants to scream. He wants to punch something, Sally preferably. Mostly, he wants to leap over whatever happens to be in his way and cover John's ears with his hands and lean his forehead against John's and whisper over and over, "I'm not a freak, I swear." He wants to squeeze those words into John's brain. And then he wants to go home and get so high he never comes down. Ever. But of course, he does neither of these things. Instead, he merely glares at Sally and cuts her down with a word and rude innuendos and goes about his merry way, all the while digging his fingernails into the palms so hard sometimes he finds crescent marks days later and thinks, "What have I gotten myself into?" More and more these days, he's finding that question maddeningly difficult to answer. 4. And when John Watson corrects Sebastian, colleague, not friend, in a voice that brooks no argument, he wants to crawl under the desk and disappear. Crawl into the dark and the quiet. Inject himself. Fall away into nothingness. Far, far away from where he is right now. And he can barely stand to look at John. If this is what it feels like to have new fucking friends, everyone can just fuck off right now, including you, Mycroft. So he looks at Sebastian instead and wants to punch him in the face hard. And he looks at the floor and he wants the comforting space beneath the desk where he can make everything all colors and no colors again. If he had the right equipment and about 10 minutes alone, and he glances at John and wants to crawl into his lap and rest his head against his shoulder and close his eyes and just hang on until everything stops hurting. But he does not do any of these things, of course. Instead, he listens to Sebastian drone on and on, and he digs his nails into his palms, while cleverly starting to snap the puzzle pieces into place in his mind. And he does not think about the man sitting beside him, and what he'd like to do with him once they were alone in the flat, unclothed. The voices of deduction fill his brain, and thank God. But later, alone in the cab with John, another voice, a small, sinister voice, starts whispering in his ear, "Tell me, what do you crave?" And even though Sherlock bloody well knows the answer to that question, the voice sounds unnervingly like Mycroft. So he tells it to shut the hell up and leave him alone. 5. And in the end, they do come home together, but they almost didn't. It all seems so surreal, like some drug-induced hallucination from years back. Colors, no colors, soft, shapeless, gray jumper that he might actually find in John's drawer. And when Sherlock closes his eyes, he almost wonders if bits and pieces of it actually happened at all. Did John actually offer his life in exchange for mine? Did John actually throw us both into the pool? Does John actually care about me? And he is too scared and too bloody sore, at least for now, to puzzle out the answers to those questions. They are both very quiet in the flat, and they both move very slowly, as if treading water. And every time Sherlock catches a glimpse of John, bent blonde head, plaid shirt, blue-gray eyes, pale of skin beneath paler bandage, Sherlock's hands start itching and twitching, and his tongue seems to fold in on itself, curling up against the back of his throat. He catches John looking at him more than once, and the way he's looking at him makes Sherlock want to take him, shake him, throw him down onto the floor and cover him with his own battered body, cover him with his mouth and his hands, because it would be, he knows, even better than getting high. Though getting high sounds pretty damn fine right now. But he does neither of these things, of course. Instead, John actually touches him. Just once. Quietly. Gently. On the elbow, of all places. As Sherlock moves past him. Because he's trying to get away. And John says his name. Softly. But it's enough. It's more than enough. Sherlock closes his eyes. When he opens them, he knows. He can only fight a craving like this for so long. 6. And he likes the way John makes him feel. It's as simple as that. And he likes the way John feels. His skin and bones and breath. His eyelashes, his hair, his glorious polyteal fossa. His ankles, his hands, his cock, his philthrum. And the end, it isn't the drugs at all. Not the cocaine, not the heroin, not even the pitiful cigarettes that his body has been craving all this time. It is just John. And, oh, this is a different kind of drug. completely different from any he has ingested, injected, snorted, sucked in over the years. He almost laughs out loud at the difference because this is heart-shattering. This is bone-splintering. This makes him shudder and shake, makes his eyes roll back, his spine arc off the bed. This is tremors and seizures and cold sweats and hot slickness between the thighs. This is mouth-devouring and knee-knocking and cock-sliding, and there will never, ever be a better way to escape his mind ever again. And when they're done, Sherlock curls onto his side, the side that is least sore, and curls into John, pulls John to him as close as he can without being inside him again, presses his teeth lightly onto John's shoulder and his nails into the ribs, feeling John squirm and sigh and reach back and place a warm palm on Sherlock's thigh. He wants to tell John that he's his best friend. He wants to tell him that he loves him. He wants to ask him to marry him. But he doesn't do any of these things. Yet. This is dangerous. This is habitual. This is incurable. He smiles against the sweat of John's skin. This is his drug of choice. If Mycroft could only see him now. The end.